Opening the show was I Am Goddess by Lisa Thiel. So thank you, Lisa. Well, as you probably can hear, I'm still a bit under the weather this week, so thank you ahead of time for excusing my voice and maybe the occasional cough or sneeze. I am much better, though, than last week, so thank you so much for your thoughtful emails, listeners. And tonight, we have a great show for you. At the top of the hour, we have the beloved foremother with us, Barbara Walker. She's going to be discussing her latest work called Man-Made God. And then at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have Patrick McCollum back on the show as well. And Patrick, well, he's going to be discussing with us everything that's happened since he was awarded the Mahatma Gandhi Award for Peace. He's going to let us know what the latest work, with the Patrick McCollum Foundation, and about his upcoming trips to Nepal and Siberia, and recent things that happened in Thailand, in the island of Java, where he was the World Inner Peace Ambassador. Lots of interesting stuff we're going to talk about, including where we stand with that court case he was involved in California with the Tier 1 and Tier 2 religions. I just want to tantalize you a little bit to start with about Barbara Walker's book, Man Named God. Let me just tell you a little bit about Barbara, just in case you're a new listener to the show, or maybe you're new to women's studies or goddess theology. Barbara, we call her a beloved foremother for a reason. She's a religious historian with an incisive understanding of the origin of Christianity and of the various pre-Christian mythologies that have been cobbled together to form the basis of one of the world's most pervasive religions. She's also the author of the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, and she's written books on the Tarot and the I Ching, and has made a wide range of texts on knitting and knitwear design. Well, she was reviewed by Peter Bycroft. Peter is a secular humanist, and he said some of these things about Barbara in her book, so I want to make sure you know just what a great show we have in store for you. He says this about Barbara, that Walker is not a militant atheist. She's a methodical, measured, and entertaining, and progressively dealing with and dismissing as fiction the majority of Christian beliefs, including whether Christ actually ever existed. The extensive amount of factual and historical evidence that Walker can draw upon as she systematically demystifies Christianity, well, it's astounding. And Man-Made God will no doubt go down in history as the turning point for a rational understanding of humanity and how humans have developed and hybridized fanciful and often oppressive religious dogma over time. It's happened in a continuum from antiquity through to modern-day Christian fundamentalism. And we're going to talk about how this actually affects us today, how it even affects us in our politics and in Congress. But before we actually start our chat with either of these favorite guests of mine, just a bit of housekeeping and some announcements. I'd like to remind listeners in Southern California that I'm giving a slide presentation and talk to the Theosophical Society in Long Beach, California, this Friday, and the topic is the practical values of the sacred feminine. It's a free talk. They always open their doors to the public for free. So for more information, you can email me or go to my website, KarenTate.com. And as to my ongoing pledge made earlier in the year, until he's back on the air in June, I always take a minute at the top of the show to honor Keith Olbermann, formerly of Countdown fame on MSNBC, who we know now will be back as the news director on Al Gore's current television, as it's called. And just in case you've missed his voice, listen close. Well, because he can't ask this question on the air himself, I'll ask the question he would have asked every night. Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters, but you perpetrated a big bait and switch on the American people. All you seem to be working on is redefining rape and trying to take the rights of women to their bodies away from them. You seem to want to dismantle social safety nets that many people rely on to live. All your party seems to be doing is taking away rights from workers. So what's next? Have you figured out a way yet to privatize the air we breathe? Well, people are waking up to your budget battle being about a culture war, not really about fixing the budget, because if you were so interested in fixing the budget, Mr. Boehner, you wouldn't have held unemployment benefits hostage to get tax cuts for the rich. You'd be looking at cutting the war budget and discontinuing the subsidies to the corporate welfare queens. And Mr. Boehner, in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, the people, well, they are starting to take back their states. Maybe it won't be long before we actually take back our country from the likes of the Tea Party and the Koch brothers. And I'm sick of hearing we have a spending problem. If we have a spending problem, it's because of the giveaways to rich corporations and millionaires and billionaires. So that's my What's the Buzz rant for the week. Thanks for letting me get those bees out of my bonnet. And just so you'll know, our show is still looking for a sponsor. Remember, Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. They do charge us every month for airtime. So we are always appreciative when someone sends in a contribution or a donation. Or if you'd permanently like to be the host of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, let me hear from you. Because like goddess ideology teaches us, what you tend to, what you nurture, what you nourish, well, it thrives. And what you neglect, sometimes it withers. So please make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please remember the three F's regarding the show. Those three F's are favorite, friend, and follow. You can just go to my show page and follow these. Mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite, if you would. Become our friend. But maybe most important, hit the follow button so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week, because I don't always get a chance to send everyone in the database an email reminder. And this way you won't miss great guests like we have tonight, Barbara Walker and Patrick McCullum. And we still have some places left on the tour to sacred goddess sites in Turkey that I'm leading this November to men and women, for men and women, sorry. Just so you'll know, we have a few seats left, and we're going to be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Şatılhöyük, Side, and Lagina. We're going to be partaking of wonderful mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite outside Aphrodisias. We'll be doing rituals at the site, dream incubations. We'll partake of Turkish baths. And did I say sacred shopping? Yeah, we'll have a lot of great fun, and Turkey is still a diamond in the rough. And so many of these places that we go to are not overrun by tourists. In fact, the few times I've led tours there before, we have totally had these sites to ourselves. Well, many of you have emailed me saying how much you like this statement of empowerment that I usually read before we get to each of our guests. So for you, my listeners, here it is again, and it goes like this. As many of you know, adversaries of the sacred feminine, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal, well, they tried to sweep away that awareness and knowledge of the great she for all time. And with that sweeping away The great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods. Well, women and their power as a result, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's why here on the show I am dedicated to recovering the great she. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women and men, and to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so we know why things are the way they are today, how they've come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural. And we're going about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, I think we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, well, it's women armed with our like-minded brothers, with ideals of the sacred feminine, who will just set things back on course. And our two mottos, the first from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer, all truths pass through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. And the second, attributed to Gandhi, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then they win. Well, let's not delay any further because we've got a lot to get to tonight. And our beloved foremother, Barbara, is patiently waiting on the phone. I want to read a little bit of Barbara's bio before we start our chat because she has accomplished so much in her lifetime, and for that we are so grateful. I've already read a little bit about her latest book and some of her work, but a little bit more here. Barbara G. Walker, she's a researcher, lecturer, author of 23 books and numerous articles on comparative religion, history, mythology, symbolism, mineral lore, the Tarot, the I Ching, a collection of original feminist fairy tales, an autobiography, a novel, and her latest, which we're going to highlight tonight, Man Made God. Her Woman's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets has been continuously in print for a quarter of a century and was named Book of the Year by the London Times. She's received the Humanist Heroine of the Year Award from the American Humanist Association, the Woman Making Herstory Award from New Jersey Now, and the Olympia Brown Award from the Unitarian Universalist Association. She's also listed in that prestigious publication, Who's Who in Hell. As an artist, she created 78 original paintings for the Barbara Walker Tarot deck and 64 more for her I Ching of the Goddess card deck, both published with companion books. She's also worked as a professional knitwear designer, and her books on knitting patterns are American classics. She personally invented more than 1,000 original pattern stitches, more than any other single person known to history, and created a new technique that she named mosaic knitting. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, she has worked as a journalist, dance teacher, painter, designer, workshop leader, and mentor of women's spirituality groups, as well as wife and mother, and has presented many talks for humanist, Unitarians, and free thinker organizations. Barbara, how did you manage to fit so much into a lifetime? I mean, some people couldn't do that in two lifetimes.
Well, to tell you the truth, I had only one child, and as soon as that child got into school, I had 6 hours a day all to myself. And I wondered, what do other housewives do with their time? You know, 6 hours a day, you could get a lot of work in.
Absolutely. Well, you were lucky that, when you did go out and pursue a career, it was by choice and not necessity, I assume?
Yes, that is true. I was very lucky to have as much free time as I did have, and I made use of it by studying, giving myself courses. I would take all the books on a certain subject out of the library, and I would sit down with them and take notes. And I still have big boxes of notes on all the stuff that I gave myself courses on. So I'm a lifelong scholar. That's what I like to do.
I can understand that. I know one a person asked me recently, on your list of things that are most important in your life, you know, name those things. And, you know, in my top three was knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so I can certainly understand that. And, you know, here you created all of those courses for yourself. I could see where you could easily sort of flip that around and actually start teaching your own classes.
Yes, I have done that too.
Well, you know, I know you told me this once before, but for listeners who maybe didn't hear, because our last interview was some time ago, how many years did it actually take you to finish the Book of Women's Secrets, the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets?
That was a 25-year project, along with other things. But basically, I was taking notes for that ever since I graduated from college and putting those notes aside as I went along. So
wow.
It's a big project. It's a 1,200-page book, so there's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I have it on my shelf, and every time I pull it out and can barely pick it up, I think about what it had to take to put that together, and you're really pretty incredible. Well, Barbara, let's get to the new work, Man Made God. Now, that just came out within the last year. Is that correct?
That's right, and it's basically a study of how the original feminist, the goddess matriarchal societies, got turned around and became patriarchal.
Okay.
And it goes into the history of Christianity throughout all the centuries in Europe and, of course, in the West in general. And basically it condemns what they call the Abrahamic religions, that means Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of which trace their origins back to the Old Testament, and all of which think of Abraham as the original founding father. The book of Genesis gives a very much worked over and outstandingly untruthful narrative, which Western civilization has been ordered to regard as history for over 2,000 years. And you may be familiar with the hymn, Morning Has Broken.
Mm-hmm.
The lyrics speak of the Garden of Eden, quote, fresh from God's word, and of God's literal footstep on the first grass. Now, we may think of that as a nice poetic metaphor, but the writer of the lyric obviously thought of it as the truth. But this story of Eden, which is the basis for all of the oppression of women, this story is not a nice poetic metaphor, nor is it true. It's a lie that was born out of ignorance. And what's more, it is a pernicious lie that caused an unimaginably huge amount of unnecessary human suffering over the centuries.
And we definitely want to get to that, but what do you believe, you know, what was the religion or the spiritualities that existed before the Abrahamic religions? You talked about the matriarchals. Can you speak a little bit about that? Because some people think, you know, it all started with the Garden of Eden. It all started with the Abrahamic religions.
Well, actually, the original religions of the human race based everything on motherhood. Motherhood was the important thing that kept the tribes together. They didn't know about fathers, of course. They had no monogamy. Their sexual preferences were just once in a while. And I think that once the men found out that they could be fathers, which took a long time because it's not obvious, and they didn't keep records of how long a pregnancy takes, and they had no idea that there was a male component in this physiological functioning.
Right.
Once they found that out, then they took over and wanted to be the parents. And as I say in Man Made God, man's patriarchal religious systems refuse to adopt the all-important measures of population control that are needed now and really were needed more than a century ago, because a large part of man's inflated self-image depends on the very concept of fatherhood, the ability to beget, to use female bodies, to increase possession of women and children. the early patriarchs looked at the one indisputable possession that was a child belonging incontrovertibly to the woman who birthed it, and they deeply envied this life-giving power of the female, which most religious systems have been belittling ever since. But patriarchal ownership is still implied by customs like the adoption of male surnames by wives and children, by the precedence of husbands in financial and property listings, and by the insistence in many fundamentalist groups that a wife must be subservient to her husband. This is still going on, and it's still being based on that ridiculous Genesis myth.
So what do you say to the people who don't believe that there were matriarchies? What evidence would you give to them that there were these egalitarian societies?
My books contain bibliographies of more than 400 books, and a lot of them are source books that show distinctly that that was the case. You simply have to look it up.
Off the top of your head, I mean, I know Chatel Hayuk was, I mean, I know we still have some in China, I think, today, some in Kerala, India, but what were a few others that can you think of off the top of your head?
Well, there were some that were found, especially in the South Pacific, only in the 19th and early 20th centuries. They've been found all over the world in what they call what they now call backward societies. But actually, they were a great deal more comfortable. For example, I give you some quotes from the book. The matriarchal societies, or mattress cultures, have been found by anthropologists to be very indulgent toward children, giving them much physical affection and little punishment, tending to be permissive in various forms of pleasure and sexuality. There are no homosexuality taboos, no concubinage, no prostitution. Women control their own fertility and their choice of mates. The sexes have equal social status, though the family is usually matriarchal and matrilineal and matrilocal. That is, married people live in the wife's home, the property is hers, and the descent is reckoned primarily through mothers. And among people that have not yet understood biological fatherhood, it's exclusively through mothers. There is a democratic division of labor. There's no caste system, no full-time military. Religion is some variant of nature worship without strict codes, a mother goddess being primary and her consorts secondary. Sexuality and love between the sexes may be considered a part of religious feeling. Such cultures were generally nonviolent and valued spontaneity, humor, and sensual enjoyments. And then we have the contrast, the patrist societies. Now, this is the really deeply patriarchal society such as we had in medieval Europe. Children are severely treated with harsh physical punishments, restriction of movement, and painful initiations. In some cultures, that included genital mutilation. Sexual attitudes are highly restrictive, ascetic, and fearful. Women's freedoms are limited and their status inferior. Marriages are arranged by others, are patrilocal and patrilineal, and frequently imply sexual and reproductive slavery for the wives and or concubines. Heavy taboos surround menstruation, childbirth, abortion, birth control, widowhood, and women's access to spiritual matters. There are full-time male clergies and military organizations and a monotheistic father god, often depicted as rigidly authoritarian, demanding, and cruel. Pain-seeking asceticism and renunciation of sexuality tend to please him. There are tight caste systems and strict codes with sadistic punishments, some of which may be used as spectacles of public entertainment. We've had that even in this country. We had public hangings and public torture. The men own the property, the women and children, and may regard war as their most honorable calling. Now, this is, of course, the extreme. And between these two extremes, there are many variations of these two kinds of cultures. But we can recognize the general trend in both cases.
Well, do you talk about in Man-Made God, Barbara, how we went from this, you know, matrilocal, matrilineal, egalitarian idea to these, you know, to the oppression of women in the Abrahamic patriarchal religions?
Well, of course. That is the basis of the book. The major, one of the foremost chapters in the beginning is called Motherhood and Power. And that explains in detail, which is much too complicated to go into, in detail exactly how this happened and how the goddess worship was put down. Actually, it never really went away. In medieval Europe, they thought they had gotten rid of all the goddess culture, but it was still there underneath. The pagans were worshiping nature, mothers of nature. They were worshiping Aphrodite. They had Venus figures. Most of them were taken over by the church and turned into Our Lady of this and that, you know,
so that
the people could keep on worshiping and just have a Christianized figure in front of them. But, of course, Mary was not truly divine in the church's view. The people were worshiping her as divine, and the church had to keep her because the people wanted her so much. But she was never declared completely divine in
now,
the sense of the old goddess.
Are you one of the believers that the Black Madonna in particular maybe more so even pointed to an underground symbol for goddess or nature and those associations?
Oh, yeah. I'm quite sure that was the case.
Okay.
The Black Madonna was older than Christianity.
Okay. Well, we know some of the statues were actually Isis when they removed the paint.
Yeah.
Well, so what, I know you can't go into a whole lot of detail, but what would you say was the basic excuse for the oppression of women by the patriarchal religions?
The basic excuse was the myth of original sin, which was supposed to be Eve's fault. Now, Eve was originally a mother goddess figure. She was Eva of the Hittites, or Haya, and she had a lot of names, but she was basically Mother Earth. She was turned into the second wife of Adam. His first wife, of course, was Lilith. And Lilith was unsuitable because she didn't like Adam. She said his sexual proclivities were not to her taste, so she left him. And she went off and lived by, this is in the Apocrypha, she went off and lived by the Dead Sea and gave birth to 100 children a day, which detail marks her as one of the original mother goddess figures. Anyway, Eve was brought in as the substitute, and she was debased into the original sinner. However, this particular myth, the early fathers of the church picked it up and just ran away with it. And they made sure that every woman was told that she was the original sinner. And because she was a daughter of Eve, she was born sinful and would always be put down by men. St. Paul made all these rules about women not being able to speak in church, not being able to have anything to do with religion. They must ask their husbands at home if they had questions. And from there, we progressed on to the Middle Ages and the witch trials and the Inquisition and the really horrible things that they did to women. It was an atrocity.
Well, you know, Barbara, for women who are still part of these patriarchal religions, I think it's really important to talk about how these patriarchal religions actually foster, you know, sexism, fanaticism, intolerance. Because, you know, I wonder if they're turning a blind eye, or if they really don't understand, you know, what's really going on beneath the surface.
Well, let me give you some quotes from a few other people other than me who I quote in the book. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the famous Elizabeth, in the 1890s wrote as follows, "The church has done more to degrade women than all other adverse influences put together. Out of the doctrine of original sin grew the crimes and miseries of asceticism, celibacy, and witchcraft. Woman becoming the helpless victims of all the delusions generated in the brain of man, the clergy everywhere sustained witchcraft as a Bible doctrine. As long as the pulpits teach women's inferiority and subjection, she can never command honor and respect. There is nothing more pathetic in all history than the hopeless resignation of woman to the outrages she has been taught to believe are ordained of God." And Mary Condren writes, quote, "The subjection of women formed one of the central ideologies of Western Christianity." Annie Laurie Gaylor states, quote, "Repudiation of patriarchal religion is an essential step in freeing women." Now, at the Second Vatican Council, we have this peculiar thing happening. Women were addressed as follows. "Women of the entire universe, you to whom life is entrusted, it is for you to save the peace of the world." Okay. At this event, women had hardly been allowed to speak, especially on the subject of saving the world. And those few women who were admitted as observers mingled with the delegates on the first day and then found themselves relegated to a coffee room thereafter, ensuring that not even on the coffee breaks could their presence contaminate the purity of the decision-making process.
So what was the point of making the big deal if it was just empty words?
That's what it is, empty words. Every time a patriarchal religious authority talks about honoring women, it is empty words. Here are the words of theologian Rosemary Radford Ruther. She says, "Women have to suspect that the entire symbolic universe that surrounds them, which has socialized them to their roles, is deeply tainted by hostility to their humanity. Women are, in fact, not inferior, but full human persons of equivalent capacities, upon whom all males as children were once dependent. And the task of suppressing women into dependence on males is a never-ending struggle, which must be reiterated generation after generation by repeating the myths of women's original sin to the young, both male and female. Religion is relied upon as both the foundation and the daily aid in this project." So it is religion that we have to deal with.
Well, we know, it wasn't, it didn't make front page news like it should have, but it wasn't that long ago that Jimmy Carter left his church and for these very reasons. And I believe he joined a group called the Elders.
Mm-hmm.
And most recently, Father Roy Bourgeois came out against the church, saying that women should be able to be ordained, otherwise it's just discrimination. So it seems like we are making some progress, in the public arena about these things, but apparently not enough, Barbara. Why, can you explain why women aren't just running away from patriarchal religions in droves? I mean, what makes them stay and, be in collusion with their oppression?
Childhood training, obviously. If they grow up in a religious household, they believe that that's the truth. Children do not doubt what they're told by their elders, because they have to learn about the whole world, and they take what they're told as gospel truth, so to speak. And if they're told that these Bible stories are real history, they believe it. How are they going to doubt it? So that's what they grow up with, and that's one of their earliest memories. And what people grow up with in a culture is pretty much what most of them stick to all their lives. I mean, if you grow up say, in Islam, and you are told that your husband can have three other wives beside you, and he can beat you if he wants, and you have to stay in your house and never go out unless you have an escort, a member of the family. All these rules you grow up with, and if you break the rules, you get punished. So it was the same way in Christianity. It's it just early training that never gets transcended. And the culture makes it very difficult always to transcend your early training, no matter what it is. Because everybody around you is believing the same thing, so where are your doubts going to come from?
Right. Well, and it's maybe too much to think when you're in this bubble that critical thinking is going to take hold and you're going to start thinking outside the box.
Well, of course, some people do.
Right,
but that is, these are the people who are naturally inclined. In the time of the Inquisition, the people who thought outside the box had horrible consequences. Let me read a little bit about that. Americans talk about the witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts, as if they were a great historic horror. But only 19 people were killed, and it was all over in a year's time. Europe's witch trials went on for centuries, 500 years, and killed a purported 9 million, most of them women, although some scholars consider this a low estimate. The church has been quietly destroying records and will admit to only a few hundred thousand fatalities, and I understand they're calling it even fewer now. But we read of whole villages where only one or two women were left alive. We read of hundreds burned in a single day, stakes as numerous as a forest of trees. One bishop proudly claimed to have executed 1,900. And a Lutheran prelate, Benedict Karpsov, claimed to have condemned 20,000 all by himself. And in relatively permissive England, some 30,000 witches were slaughtered. The women who were tortured and burned were accused of crimes ranging from being a midwife, possessing a cat, or having intercourse with the devil. Often, the smartest, the most outspoken, the most beautiful, educated, or wealthy women in a community would be singled out for murder by the female-hating celibate clergy. Almost the entire female population of a town could be immolated in a single day. In one German city, 900 women were burned in one day. In one French city, 400 in a single day. An inquisitor of Como, Italy, was quoted as having burned 1,000 witches a year. When such reports are multiplied by thousands of inquisitors and 500 years, the comparison with Salem, Massachusetts seems a little unbalanced, for which
right.
The United States may thank its tradition of religious freedom. That was very important.
So, Barbara, let me ask you, what we see going on here, are two things really at play? This all probably started... maybe not really because they believed, we were the daughters of Eve and therefore we carried that sin. Was it really just the naked desire for control or, to just set men above women and this was just a convenient excuse? I'm just wondering what your opinion is.
Well, it was both. Of course, they wanted to put down women and keep them enslaved, but a lot of them firmly believed in the original sin myth because it was taught to them as history. It was taught to them as children. It was taught to them all through school. It was taught to them by their priests every Sunday when they went to church.
Right.
So why would they doubt it?
Right, right. Well, and I'm wondering, too, your opinion on something else. It's been pretty heated debate on places like Facebook because I think France just passed the law banning Islamic women from wearing the veil. And you have this heated debate between the people saying, well, now the women can be liberated. And then you have other women saying, well, some of these women really do want to wear that veil. And then, and the response is, they're brainwashed. That's why they want to wear the veil. And I guess I'm just curious, where do you stand on these different diverging opinions?
Well, those who do not wear the veil are often found out that they are abused and insulted in the street. The things are thrown at them. We have read of occasions where women had acid thrown in their faces, and they were beaten. All kinds of bad things happen to the women who don't wear the veils when they're told to. So, you know, for just self-preservation, they want to go on doing it. You could certainly understand that.
Right.
They feel very threatened without it. So I can understand why they would be afraid to leave it off.
Right.
The Islamic fundamentalists now are pretty much the ones in power, and they're enforcing these things and making things pretty miserable for women. There's a book by, what is her name? I can't remember. I read so many books recently on this. Noni Garwish. Noni Garwish's book is written by an Islamic woman who was a good Muslim till she was reached the age of 30 and began to get educated. And she has written very, very emotionally about this issue, and I recommend her book highly.
It's called
Cruel and Unusual Punishment.
So the educated Islamic woman is against the headscarf.
Some are, some aren't. It depends on where they are, where they grew up, what their principles are. Certainly there are good Muslims, women who consider themselves good Muslims, who are educated. And there are many who are not educated, are not allowed to be educated. So, you know, it's a very individualized thing. You can't make sweeping generalizations about
it. Right. So you can't look at it and say, like we do in the West, and we all, so many of us see it as a form of oppression, but they don't necessarily.
Some do, some don't.
Okay. Women
now can wear bikinis, and 50, 100 years ago, they would have been persecuted in this country for showing that much skin.
That's right. That's right. I remember in Catholic school how our skirts had to be a certain length, or they would send you home.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to have head covering to go to church, that little chapel veil. Well,
that's an interesting little sidelight, the head covering. It says in one of St. Paul's epistles that all women must have covering on their heads in church. And it says, because of the angels. Now, that word, angels, originally meant something like spirits, not necessarily heavenly angels. In the ancient world, it was believed almost everywhere that women's hair attracts spirits. And in medieval Europe, when witches wanted to summon spirits, it was said that they let their hair loose and the spirits would come. And that was what St. Paul's rule meant. He was so afraid that the women would have non-Judaic spirits coming to their hair. So they had to be covered. In Orthodox Judaism, women actually had to shave their heads completely and be bald. Get rid of all that hair. And also women's hair has been very important in Hindu belief. It's always had this kind of sacredness about it. Men seem to have been a little nervous about women's hair right from the beginning. And
well,
that's why you have hats in church.
Well, do you think maybe it's also they found it sensual and that sort of scared them to death?
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Sensuality scared them to death from the very beginning.
Well, and I'm vaguely remembering when I was writing my own book about Turkey that not that long ago, I'm sure within the last 5 or 10 years, there was this elderly Turkish female scholar who was actually jailed because she was teaching in her college classes that the head covering actually went back to pre-Islamic times, and it had to do with sexual rights rights for women and men. Mm-hmm. And I found that incredibly interesting because, you know, now, you know, the Muslims have adopted it, but not even maybe even really knowing it, where it came from originally, or wanting to deny it, possibly.
Did the Catholics ever tell you why you had to wear a hat in church?
No.
Of course not. Yes, it does go way, way back. Among the Sikhs, there is a rule about men's hair. Men are forbidden to cut their hair, ever. And there are two places in the Bible. One says that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace. And in another place, the Bible contradicts itself constantly. It says if a man doesn't cut his hair, it's a disgrace. So the hair has been an important religious issue from the very beginning, apparently.
I can see. Well, we have probably about 15 or 20 minutes, and I have some other questions I want to make sure we get to. Why does the biblical God demand blood sacrifice before he grants forgiveness of sin?
This, again, goes back to the matriarchy. Blood was considered the stuff of life because women produce blood from their wombs except when they're gestating. And that means that the child is being made of that blood. And that was a universal belief throughout the ancient world. Pliny talks about it. Plato talks about it. The baby is formed in the womb out of blood. Therefore, blood is the essential magic stuff of life. So most people believed that in order to make their gods and goddesses live, they had to give them blood. This was the origin of blood sacrifices. So they would kill an animal, or a child, or a prisoner of war, or a slave, or somebody, and let the blood flow out on the altar, and this would be pleasing to the god or goddess. The biblical God insisted on blood sacrifices. He said, All salvation is brought about only by blood. By blood you are brought back. So the God himself demanded blood. All through the Old Testament, it gives rules for sacrificing animals or birds or doves or sheep or something on God's altar. This is the origin of kosher killing. In kosher killing, the blood has to be all drained out of the animal because the blood goes to the deity. This is why.
But of course, the woman's blood, the men's seed, that of course wasn't sacred. That was taboo.
It was taboo because they call it unclean in the Bible. But that word unclean is a translation of a word that really means taboo, which means sacred, untouchable, something that men must not mess with. Among the early Greeks, the women had menstrual rituals where they would be separated from the rest of the culture. And the Gorgon face indicated that it was taboo and no men must come anywhere near. If they do, they will be turned to stone. And a lot of the old writers said men may die if they walk between two women and one of them is menstruating and so forth. It's been a very, very hard thing to deal with. But the biblical God wanted the blood of Jesus. Jesus was sacrificed only because there was a tradition of blood sacrifice to appease God and make him a little less cruel. So in order to get rid of original sin, this great big sacrifice had to be made. And when I was reading the Bible as a child and I read how Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane that God would let him off and not make him do this, and I thought, what a cruel father. What father would do this to his son?
Is that when you decided that God wasn't good?
Oh, reading the entire Bible made me decide that God was not good. He is such a brute. Let me see. There are so many cruelties. In the book, I write this paragraph. The biblical God has advocated and endorsed sexism, rape, child abuse, battery, bigotry, torture, theft, fraud, perjury, extortion, forgery, war, murder, and genocide. This God has biblically confessed to wiping out whole populations at a whim and even destroying the whole earth and all its creatures because a few humans dared to ignore him. He has biblically described himself as the creator of evil. That's in Isaiah 45:7. And Jesus said he was not the bringer of peace on earth, but he brought a sword. That's in Matthew 10:34. And Robert Ingersoll called that the only biblical prophecy ever fulfilled.
The sword.
The sword.
The sword. Well, you know, I mean, look, if you just look at it from the standpoint of, would you want to know this guy? Would you want
Absolutely.
Him for your neighbor or your brother or your husband or your friend? Say, no, this guy's a sociopath. He needs to be locked up in prison. We wouldn't want him for our God, for heaven's sake.
That's exactly how I felt about it. And as soon as I went to Sunday school and saw this terrible picture of a bleeding Jesus, life-size picture looking in agony, and I'm thinking, his father did this to him?
Yeah, what a father.
I don't want anything to do with that father.
It would be murder. Well, now, is this all this blood thing, is that also where the circumcision comes from?
Oh, sure. There were lots of ways in which men tried to imitate Menarche. They had cutting the penis, they had circumcision, they had subincision. Some societies really subjected the boys to very severe bloodlettings in order to make them fertile. They wanted them to be fertile in the women's way. And there are lots of myths about gods who gave blood out of their penises to bring children to birth and all that kind of thing. And they were always trying to make gods seem like birth givers.
Mm-hmm.
In some way or another,
Zeus's head.
They were very jealous of that particular function.
Yeah.
And
well,
of
I
course,
mean, you write. I remember reading in your book. You said that originally, menstrual blood was coveted by kings and leaders. They thought it gave them power or immortality, and it made sense to me. Well, what you can't make yourself, but yet you covet it. Well, then you know you want to diminish it. You want to make it less powerful. You make it taboo and unclean to sort of demystify it or you know take its power away.
Well, it was also taboo because it was feared. Like, let's say, an altar. A Catholic church makes the altar taboo for women. Women are not supposed to touch the altar, which is why they only have altar boys and never altar girls,
mm-hmm.
at least up until fairly recently.
But don't forget, it's taboo because
it is sacred.
But she could go dust the altar. I do remember she could go dust the altar when it wasn't mass time. Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. But.
As long as she's not menstruating. Up until the 18th century, menstruating women were not allowed to enter the church.
Maybe that's why it was usually gray-haired ladies who were dusting the altar.
It could be. But they, you know, God's power was not big enough to stand up against this magic. This was something really terrible.
Wow. Well, tell me about the story behind the Jesus fish.
Oh, yeah, that's funny. You know, it's a sidewise pointed oval, and this particular sign used to be known as the mandorla, which means the almond, and once it was a magic nut that fertilized the Virgin Mother of the Savior God, Attis. Originally, it was the vesica piscis, which means vessel of the fish, and that was understood throughout the ancient world as a female genital symbol. It was a yoni, and of course it was vertical rather than horizontal. Fish were sacred to the goddess, whose womb was the sea, like Aphrodite, and it was said that women's genital secretions smell like fish. There was even an aspect of the primal goddess, Kalima, described as named fishy smell, whose real name was truth. Now this goddess and her Western counterparts, the Sheila Na Gig, statues of old Celtic churches. Have you seen those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, with the genitals exposed.
Squatting goddess displaying her yoni, her gate mm-hmm. of life, in the form of the vesica piscis. Early Christian art adopted this same symbol as a frame for the figure of the baby Jesus, which is as imposed on Mary's belly, or a kind of halo surrounding the figures of Jesus and Mary. Fish were long ago recognized as totems of Aphrodite because they were thought of as aphrodisiac food. They were eaten on the goddess's sacred day, which was Friday, named after her Roman counterpart, Venus in French, Italian, and Spanish. That's Vendredi, Venerdi, Viernes, and her Teutonic counterpart, Freya, in German and Swedish and Yiddish. The Roman Church took over the goddess's Friday fish eating, but declared it a holy fast, that it was a sin to break. The takeover was rationalized by claiming that the Greek word for fish, which is ichthys, was a secret acronym for Jesus Christ, Son of God. And still, we must laugh, I do, every time I see one of the world's oldest yoni symbols unknowingly displayed on a fundamentalist bumper sticker.
And little do they know. And I remember too reading that not just the fish, but the fish and the net were symbols, I think, of Inanna Ishtar, and then later down the road they become symbols of Mary and Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, so Christians just really have to get a handle on their pagan roots. They really do.
They took every single one of the pagan culture. There is not one single phrase anywhere in the Gospels that is original. All of it comes from earlier sources, and many of these earlier sources are now found, and they've been plagiarized almost word for word. Every single one of the symbols of Christmas, you know, the virgin birth, the pine tree, the star, the wise men, the whole thing, all came from the worship of Mithra and some of the other savior gods. There is not one original thought of these traditions, which is really bizarre, because they're claiming now that they were original when they certainly were not.
Well, Barbara, we have probably 5 minutes left, and we'll have to conclude. And I have two questions left. So if they're two quick answers, I'm wondering, why did medieval Christian authorities preach hatred for the Jews?
That, again, goes back to the blood symbolism. It says in Matthew 27:25, that when Jesus was having a trial in front of Pontius Pilate, the Jews gathered together said, "His blood be on us and on our children." And this was supposed to mean that all the Jews through all the generations were cursed as being killers of Jesus, Christ killers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was God who killed Jesus, not the Jews. But in any case, the phrase didn't really mean that at all. The phrase originally meant, "This blood should be on us to bring us to salvation. This is the holy blood of the Lamb. We are washed in the blood and we are saved." And this is what all the Savior God figures had spoken over them at some point during their immolation, during their sacrifice. And it was a traditional term of the sacrificial proceeding. So they were saying that we will be washed in the blood and we will be saved forever. The Romans had a very similar custom. They called it the tarabolium, and they killed the bull instead of a human, and they had this killing take place over top of a grating, and the worshiper would stand underneath the grating and literally wash in the blood as the animal was killed up above. And that was bringing them eternal life, according to their writings. So this idea of a blood sacrifice and being washed in the blood is a very, very old one. Blood being a very holy substance from the very beginning, and we know why.
Well, and I have to throw this out here because I find it so interesting. Anybody who can rent the HBO miniseries Rome, they really did some incredible jobs of depicting some of these ancient rituals, and they actually did the one you just referred to, where this affluent woman stands under a bull, and they slit the bull open, and the blood just falls down on her, and mm-hmm. she, of course, thinks she's saved, and her sins are forgiven now.
Right.
It was pretty incredible to see something like that so well done on television.
Yeah, and they also, of course, ate the flesh of the bull, and that's the original
the Eucharist.
Communion, the Eucharist, the flesh and the blood were literally, the Catholic Church still says that the wine and bread are literally flesh and blood, but nobody else says that anymore.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
It was a much cheaper substitute for actual beef and blood. The animals that they killed, they always ate. You know, God didn't want the meat, he just wanted the blood.
Right.
So
right.
The meat went to the worshipers, which was a big religious feast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not so much done anymore.
Yeah, I remember reading something about outside Artemis's temple in Ephesus. They actually had, the temple actually owned a slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And finally, real quickly, Barbara, because this is maybe one of the most important questions of all, how did the idea of a father god replace the original mother goddess?
You know, in many ways and in many instances, the basic idea that was passed on into Christianity was that a woman's womb has nothing to do with making the baby. It is sperm that makes the baby. And it's like putting seed in the earth. The earth has nothing to do with it. But the baby is considered a part of the man. So up until the 18th and early 19th centuries, when they finally discovered the human ovum, most people believed that mothers did not contribute anything to their infants, that it was all from the father.
We were just the incubators.
Yeah, exactly. And that was why they believed that women didn't really amount to much. They were just soil for the sacred seed. And that's one of their major, I believe there are some people who are still saying that. I think in Islam it is still put that way. They don't believe in the human ovum.
Well, you know, and I think we can see from everything you've shared with us in the last almost an hour that, you know, this is why we're still fighting the fights on Capitol Hill today, just like, you know, the right-wing agenda to defund Planned Parenthood. It's amazing that we haven't progressed beyond such oppression, quite frankly. I mean, people have to learn how to connect the dots between the patriarchal religions and politics, quite frankly.
It is amazing, and I wish that more women would read more of the recent literature about the progress of Christianity, because they really don't know where their traditions are coming from and what's been done to them through these traditions. So I think it's important to read up on these matters.
Well, and I can't help but think that if they really understood they were perpetuating oppression, you know, even if it wasn't for themselves but for their daughters,
yeah.
that it would, you know, that they would somehow, you know, stop enabling the patriarchy.
Well, many of them have, but we need many more.
Absolutely.
And I
well,
hope
Barbara,
that what you do will help.
Well, thank you. And, of course, you and your more than 23 books, thank you. Thank you for your lifetime of work. And thank you for continuing to do what you do. Your book, Man-Made God, this is the latest one. Is it available the usual places, Amazon, local bookstores?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. It's even available on Kindle.
On Kindle. Okay. Well, Barbara, thank you so very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to have to go out and get this book. Even if I know a lot of the stuff that's in it, you always have new kernels that I can add to my repertoire of talks and discussions. Thank you so much. You have enriched so many of our lives.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. Some of us call the great She a deity. Some of us look at her as an archetype or an ideal. But, you know, what comes along with Goddess, these new values, these benchmarks, they can change the world. And you've been listening to Barbara Walker discuss her latest book, Man-Made God. And, you know, I would encourage everyone to go out and get it, especially if you can't take a woman's studies class or a goddess studies class where you live. Barbara has devoted her life to this work, and it's really important for our evolution, especially for the empowerment of women. And it's that time where we're going to cross the threshold into the second half of the show. And my next guest is another returning favorite. I feel so special and lucky tonight to have both Barbara and Patrick McCollum on the show. Many of you might have heard Patrick, you know, on previous shows, or you've been following his incredible work in the world. Let me just take a minute here and unmute him and say good evening. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. How are you, Karen?
I'm doing really well. I'm so glad you were able to find a phone tonight.
Yes, I did. I'm way out in the middle of the wilderness, but I do have a phone.
Well, lucky you. I think a lot of us would envy you being out in the middle of the wilderness.
Yes. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, you were going to bring us up to date tonight. You have been doing so many things. First, should we talk about where things stand with the Tier 1 and Tier 2, you know, lawsuit, the political fight going on in California?
I think that's a good place to start.
Okay, maybe just a little bit of back history for someone who's, you know, hearing about this for the first time or doesn't know the difference between Tier 1 and Tier 2 religion.
Okay. So here is the gist of what took place over a period of years. I discovered that the state of California, the government, in particular, I discovered it in the California Department of Corrections, which is the prison system, but it also goes into mental health, veteran services, and other similar agencies of the government, that they have a two-tiered system as to the rights and accommodation of faith. So what they have done is they have designated five state faiths. Originally, they designated one state faith, basically Christianity. Well, they allowed both Catholicism and Protestant Christianity, and then the Jews sued and got added to that, and then the Muslims sued and got added to that, and then the Native Americans sued and got added to that. So when they started off, they were really trying to have one pretty basic group. And so in the course of this, it came to light that their position is that those who belong to the five faiths who they've designated have all the rights under the Constitution of the United States, and also under the California Constitution, but that other faiths that are not those five faiths have a different set of rights, and that they all have, all the non-five faiths or non-state-sanctioned faiths have equal rights to one another. And so their position is, as long as they discriminate against any one of those non-mainstream faiths, then it's okay to discriminate against all of them. So let me give you a couple examples. In the prison system, Protestant Christianity receives an average of probably three or four services and videos and concerts and things like this constantly all the time, but they get about three or four services every week. They get libraries full of books, and in some cases there will be a couple of hundred inmates, and there will be volunteers for each and every inmate to help them with their Bible studies and things like this. As a pagan, a goddess worshiper, the men and women who were in the prison who asked to have a service sometimes go for, I'd say 4 or 5 years at a time before they're allowed to have a service. If they ask for a book, they're told that they're not allowed to have access to any books on our particular, faiths. They are not allowed to have religious materials and all kinds of things like this. A really great example, just to sort of show you how it goes, is I work as a chaplain in the prisons for Wiccans, goddess worshippers, nature worshippers, those groups like that. And one day I had gotten approved to bring a violin in to play some music in the course of one of the ritual services that I had managed to get approved. And so when I came into the prison, they stopped me and they told me I couldn't bring the violin in because they said that it was too much of a security risk and it was too dangerous to bring into the prison. Well, I'm security conscious and I try to follow the law, so I go, okay, well, I could live with that if it's really a security issue. But while I was standing there, a Christian rock band came in with like 6 guitars, 2 basses, drum sets, amplifiers, cymbals, light show, all the stuff like that. And they waved them all in so that they could do a thing in their religious services. And it became really apparent to me what the difference was as to how we're treated and they're treated.
Right.
So I sued the state both on behalf of myself as a chaplain, because I believe that they need to allow chaplains or religious people, whatever terms they use to call themselves, priestesses, etc., to be able to have the same access to members of our different faiths as the people in these 5 special faiths. And so I sued one on our behalf in that way, but also on behalf of all the inmates and all the minority faiths, that they should be treated equally. And the state has fought that for now. It's going into its 7th year. There have been millions of dollars spent on this lawsuit. It's gone through all kinds of trials and, various interesting information. In the course of the lawsuit, the state destroyed thousands of documents that were required by the court, which was showing how they were accommodating the faith. And they say that they accidentally shredded and destroyed, after they were ordered to produce them, there's something like 11,000 documents. Then the head of the state religion programs testified that the reason that the people from the minority faith weren't getting their services is because they'd done a study and determined that these majority faiths needed to have actual people helping them to run services and to guide them and to counsel them and things like that. But all our faith didn't need those things.
Now, how did they come to that conclusion?
Well, they said they did a study and that they both interviewed inmates and experts and such and did a whole study, and that's why they were accommodating the 5 faiths.
Sounds kind of lame, doesn't it?
Well, listen to this. In federal court, the government, testified under oath that they had done this. Then we discovered in a discovery they had never done it or even approached the question at all. So when we brought that to the state and we're going to file charges, criminal charges, against the individuals who were testifying on their behalf, they made a deal and said they would admit that they had perjured themselves in court rather than being prosecuted. So they did actually formally, both in writing and verbally, admit that they'd actually, committed perjury in the course of this whole lawsuit. Well, it didn't seem to them as though they were winning or getting very far, so they tried a different strategy, and their next strategy was that I'm the primary person who brought the lawsuit. So they, after 5.5 years, brought it to the court that they didn't think that I had standing to sue on behalf of either myself or the inmates. And so that has gone on to court, to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. and it went before a three-judge panel in October of last year, and then those judges heard oral arguments and all these thousands of documents, etc., and they're currently deciding whether or not the suit could even be brought forward. Now, the other thing that was kind of interesting in this lawsuit is, besides myself suing, I had many other people who wrote supporting briefs who came onto our side of the argument. And who came on was all the correctional chaplains in the United States from all faiths, even including Christian chaplains. Then Jewish organizations came on, Muslim organizations came on, Buddhist organizations came on, the Parliament of the World's Religions came on, the Harvard Pluralism Project came on, etc., etc., etc. So basically everyone came on and said it was ridiculous and this was an obvious violation of the Constitution, and they all wrote things on our behalf to the court. The state, in its defense, turned in one support brief to support their position, and that brief argued that if you read the wording in the Constitution, it was only meant to give rights, you know, religious rights and protections under the Constitution to a particular form of Christianity, and that no one else is even actually a religion under the law of the United States.
Now, that's crazy, because we know the Founding Fathers were not, a lot of them weren't even big on Christianity.
Well, the state argued that that's a lie. So,
what I just said was a lie?
Yes.
Were these Tea Party people?
No. This was kind of started before the Tea. Well, I know, but that's one of their things. What is so interesting about it? I'd just like to make this one comment about the whole system, is that the way the system is currently set up, the truth in these kinds of court cases when there are these religion issues doesn't come out for 5 or 6 years. And the whole process is a process of trying to keep the real information from ever getting to the court. So there's been all these strategies of how do we keep this from getting in, and how do we keep from that from getting in, how do we keep this person from testifying and that person from testifying, you know, so that when it actually gets before the court, there's nothing left. But in this case, most of the case is still together. The question is whether or not I have a right to sue. And there's two primary arguments over whether or not I have a right to sue. And the first argument was that under the Constitution and under the law, it says that I have a right to sue if I'm a taxpayer and that my taxes are utilized for the specific thing that I'm suing over. And it so happens that in California, there's an actual legislative process where the legislature has set a specific amount of tax money aside for the chaplaincy and religion programs, and it's an actual line item in the legislature and voted on.
So let them try to deny that one.
And so, well, they have denied it, but it's one of the things the court is looking at.
Okay.
So all these things, I mean, they're obvious to people like you and me, but, you know, the state does not want to give rights to minority faiths.
Well, you've said in a previous interview that, piggybacks so well on what Barbara was just talking about, you know, the oppression of the Abrahamic religions, in this case Christianity. I mean, you've said before that, you know, Christians have basically infiltrated, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we even use the word, they have infiltrated all aspects of government, and if you're not a Christian, well, it's really hard to get a fair shake if, you know, you're a pagan, you know, maybe fighting for anything, you know, rights over your children or fair wages or I don't know, I'm just throwing these things out here, but am I remembering our previous conversation correctly?
You're absolutely correct. I personally have been involved in helping with thousands of cases where non-Christians, well, and I'd say to start off with just people in goddess religions have been specifically discriminated against because of their beliefs in the system. And it is true that, you know, pretty much the court system, the government system, the whole shebang is all kind of like a closed group, you know, and so they all kind of help each other throughout the system. And they look at it as when we say, you know, well, you know, I worship the goddess and I want to be able to have an equal right to worship to, say, a Protestant who's worshiping Jesus, they laugh. You know, because they actually think it's so ridiculous that I would ask for that, that it's not even worth thinking about.
Right.
And
right.
So that's a perspective we have to change. But it is changing gradually. So there is a new little, well, there's a couple new glitches in this case. So the case went before the Ninth Circuit, and they are considering it and deciding what ruling to make, and they have, as of yet, made a ruling. But and a couple interesting things have happened. The first thing that happened is it's a three-judge panel, which I had told you, and one of the judges just passed away. So now that the judge has passed away, the whole case, several things can happen. The entire case can go before the Ninth Circuit again, and we get to argue further to convince the new judge what things are and where we are. Or the new judge can elect to just read the papers and the transcripts and such of the case and then rule on that. But there is now a new judge, a woman, who's been included on the case. And I don't want to say too much about it because, you know, I think it's good to get into it. But I feel good about the case going forward. I just like to say that.
So and is this taking longer than the average case would? Or does it normally take this long?
Well, I would say it's not. It is definitely taking longer. But the reason it's taking longer is because the state is fighting tooth and nail. In other words, they have put everything they've got, all their resources in this case. This is a big case to them because if we win this case, they'll have to treat everyone equally.
Right.
And up to this date, they haven't had to do that, and so they're very, very, very dug into that situation. Another interesting thing is that many of the individuals involved at the different prisons who are the ones who discriminate against the minority faith are actually ministers of Protestant faiths. So there's even an additional kind of twist to it all, you know?
Right, right.
So you'll go to the person who is the chaplain, the Protestant chaplain who's supposed to help the pagans, and the Protestant chaplain will say they won't do it. So you go to the person who's over the religion programs at the prison, a community partnership manager, and that person is a minister. And then you go to the associate warden over that person's head, and that person is a minister. And then you go to the warden, and they go to the same church as the other people or something. You know, so it's
right. Yeah, it's a clique.
It is definitely a little difficult.
Right.
But,
right.
I am hoping that we will have a ruling in the fairly near future on that case. And then what will happen is if they rule in our favor, then we go back to the original judge, and then the actual case moves forward on its merits with a jury and such, and all the evidence gets presented.
Oh, so then you still have to go to a jury.
Have to still do the whole thing. But there is one other twist to it, and that is we've asked the Ninth Circuit Court to just rule in our favor right now. And the argument we use for that is that the state has already admitted that they committed perjury on the only elements of the case that could make it so that they could win.
Wow.
So they've already perjured themselves and told the court that they have. So we've told the Ninth Circuit, you know, we've asked them, they don't have to do this, but it's something they do have the power to do. We said instead of spending, you know, $1 million having a whole trial and having people all over the place, the state's already said they lied. You know,
right.
So why don't you just rule now?
Right.
You know, so that's kind of where that case is.
Well, I can't wait to see the headline in the L.A. Times when you win, Patrick.
Well, I can't
either. On the front
page.
Well,
I will tell you one other thing. It's not an easy thing. And nowadays when I look at people in these different kinds of cases, you know, where they're fighting over religious rights or human rights and such, I have a lot more empathy for them. I always did have, but I have a lot more now after actually being in it, because it really takes your entire life up. You have to give your whole life up to pursue this. But the thing is I cannot lose this case. I have to win this case because it's for all of us.
Right, absolutely. You're definitely invested. Well, when the Native Americans and the Jews and the Muslims had to sue for equal rights, did they have to go through what you're going through right
they
now,
did,
or
yeah.
It's a much easier process for them?
No, they really went through very much the same kind of process.
Okay.
And the
all
difference
right.
is that this case, I'm not only arguing that we should get rights, I'm arguing that all minority faiths should get rights and that the whole system is corrupt. The other religions that had argued were just trying to get their specific rights for them. And so this case is bigger because it's an umbrella for everyone going forward.
Okay,
and,
all right.
And I want to tell you one other little twist that's gone on in this whole group of stuff, and that is that the state has argued that I couldn't be qualified to be a chaplain or to facilitate religious services because I don't belong to one of the five faiths. Okay? And that I couldn't possibly have training or background or whatever it is to make it so I could be qualified to do so.
Right.
But so since the case has started, I am now the director of the National Correctional Chaplaincy Directors Association, and I'm the head person who trains all the heads of religion programs in every correctional system in the United States on chaplaincy issues. That's first. Second, I'm now in the executive council of the American Correctional Chaplains Association, and I'm specifically on the standards committee for chaplaincy. In other words, I help to determine what the standards are for hiring a chaplain and what their qualifications have to be. You know, so it's just so crazy.
So it
you
makes
know.
It hard for them to say you don't have any credentials, doesn't it?
Well, I think that's why they're trying to make this other strategy of let's just get the case never heard.
Right.
You know.
Right.
You know. So.
And for listeners who don't know, you've also testified before Congress on these sorts of matters.
Sure.
You've advised the Obama administration. I mean, you know, you're a mover and a shaker, and for them to try to diminish you like that, as well as our spirituality, it's just, you know, it's an abomination, you know?
It really is an abomination, but, you know, I had heard a little bit about, on your earlier talk, the end part of Barbara speaking, you know, just talking about the feminine, divine, and that that spirit, and you know, when did goddess become god, and all these kind of things like this. And I want to tell you that the one thing that carries me and drives me through this entire case and all the rest of it is that I accepted and was compelled by the goddess, by the feminine divine, to do this work.
Yeah.
And that is why I've been doing that work. She guides me. When I go to court, she tells me what to say. My attorneys listen to what it is that I say, that the goddess said to say. And, you know, we're doing okay.
Yeah,
so,
you have the tenacity of Sekhmet, that's for sure.
I'm trying. So, but anyway, I think those are the main things relating to that particular part of the work that I'm doing pretty much nationally right now. And I also am advising some correctional systems in other countries too.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is most people are wanting to try to change it. They know there's something wrong with the system, and they're trying to change it. And since I brought this lawsuit and started training government officials around the country, many correctional systems are making changes. You know, it's slow and it's tough, but they do see the error in their ways. A number of them.
Well, that's
hopeful. There are some who are very dug in, you know, and
right,
and not
right.
going to be making that change.
Right. Well, you know, we could talk about religious oppression for the whole hour.
Yes, let's not.
but let's talk about some of the positive. Well, not that that isn't positive, but you know, let's talk about some of the good things that have been happening. The things that aren't so much of a struggle. Let's put it that way. You've been to Thailand and Java. You're about ready to go to Nepal and Siberia. What do we want to hear about all of that?
Well, I think that something really unique is happening, and I sure wouldn't credit it to myself. It's the work of many people coming together, and I just seem to be in the right place at the right time, I think. But, you know, I have for 40 years openly spoken of my belief and recognition and connection with the goddess, and I've stayed in that position and done all my work in relationship to that. And I have now gotten into a much larger venue on a world stage, really, I would say, from that perspective. And so there's been a number of different things that happened. First of all, I was selected to address the United States Commission on Civil Rights back a few years ago, and as a goddess worshiper, as a pagan. And I testified, and they created new laws and reports for the president and Congress and such, where they used a number of the things that I specifically stated and worded. They used it as the actual material law and suggestions for the government moving forward. So it says right in there, you know, Patrick McCollum, a Wiccan priest and chaplain, you know, said there's the dominant religious lens factor. That is that right now the government looks at everything through a religious lens of the dominant faith, Christianity. And so when they see something, if it doesn't look like Christianity, they think there's something wrong with it, or they try to do something to keep it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that happened. Then, I was like...
You got the Mahatma Gandhi Award.
Well, yeah. Let's see. So I came back from a trip fighting for that, and lo and behold, I was selected to win the Mahatma Gandhi Award for the advancement of pluralism, and I got to go to the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and there were three awards given, and kind of the highest one was Gandhi, then there was a second one, and the third one, I don't remember the names. And so the person who got the award, the next award below me, was the Solicitor General for the United States.
Wow.
And the next person that got the award was a senator from somewhere in the South. I don't remember, a Republican senator. And then here I am, a goddess worshiper, you know, getting the main award and stuff. It was really very
did they let you
moving.
Sit next to him?
Yes. We sat next
I'm
to
just
each other
kidding.
And took each other's hands and got lots of pictures, you know? And so, I mean, you know, that was kind of a first. So I was breaking some barriers.
Absolutely.
And then I got invited to address the leaders of 75 countries in Kazakhstan with world leaders and world spiritual leaders and such, where we were addressing the issue of world peace and sustainability for the planet. And I speak from my position of my spirituality on these subjects. So I have an idea how world peace should be and everything based on, you know, how the traditions based on feminist spirituality and stuff come from. And so I speak from that perspective. And I was lucky enough and honored to be able to speak before Parliament in Kazakhstan and address all these leaders of countries. And that bumped up into a series of other fantastic, you know, opportunities that I got to be involved in.
In all of these places, you're there as a goddess advocate.
Yes. Now, openly and advertised as such, you know, in other words,
right.
that they put in the
right.
program and such. So then, but then I came back from that, and then I got, I had the honor of being selected by the Buddhists to be a world inner peace ambassador for Buddhism. And so they flew me to Thailand, and I got to participate in a ceremony with 150,000 Buddhists from around the world outside of Bangkok. And then I had the honor of going with Lama Ganchen, who is the head of the World Peace Foundation, on a separate trip to the island of Java. And I mean, just the series of experiences I got to have are beyond anything that one could imagine. And,
well, Patrick, I'm curious, as they're embracing you as a goddess advocate, mm-hmm. Are they, I'm trying to find the words, are they as surprised as you as they're embracing a man who, you know, reveres goddess, or are they just, you know, that open and, you know, maybe they even believe in the sacred feminine themselves?
I think it's a little of each. So one of the things that happens is that, you know, I try to put the things that I believe in, you know, that my particular spirituality, you know, directs me toward, into language that can be understood by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of the things, I speak now, I've moved into another realm, the realm of world peace and sustainability for the world. And so I begin my talks off by saying, listen, whether you think that there's some god, you know, big guy with a beard that made everybody get created, or whether you think it's a goddess that made everybody created, or whether you think it's two atoms smashing together and there's nothing, you know, divine about it that made it all happen, we would all still agree generally, there's always somebody who won't agree, but most would all agree that everything originated at some point. In other words, there's some initiating point that all of us and everything you see around us came from. For me, that's the goddess. But here's the bottom line. If that is true for all of us, then we are all family. We are all brothers and sisters because we're made of the same stuff. And if we look at it from that position, then all the stuff that we're made of is sacred. And what we need to do is look at our brothers and sisters and the earth that we live on as being sacred. And if we do that, we will have world peace. And
so here's the big question, though.
Yes.
Okay, I hear you, and I get the sense that when you're going to these places, I mean, it's probably like the Parliament of World Religions. I mean, they have a sense of the sacred. And forgive me if I don't choose my words properly here. I hope I get the gist across.
Okay.
So, all right, so you can speak to these people using their language. How do we speak to Tea Party people? How do we speak to right-wing people who would consider you an abomination? I mean, can that be bridged to for these people who don't believe in global warming, who don't think the earth is sacred, who thinks, you know, the Queen of Heaven is the whore of Babylon? Can that be bridged, and how?
I believe it can. I've bridged it myself several different times. I mean, I've even been in a direct debate with one of the foremost fundamentalist Christian authors on radio back last year. And, you know, he would say things, well, you know, you're evil, you're this, you're that. And I'd say, well, actually, from my faith's perspective, you know, we just like to love you. And, you know, I truly understand that you have a bunch of problems and we have a bunch of issues, but the bottom line is you're my brother and, you know, I want to treat you the same way you treat me. Is that not how you believe? You know, and if you just speak the truth and you bring things forward, sure, there's people who argue and tell you there's abomination and such, but I think where we begin to see the shift is one of the very big fundamentalists, I can't remember who it was, but it's, you know, somebody big like Pat Robertson or somebody like that, said, you know, I was really worried about those goddess worshippers and pagans. They're like from the devil. But you know what, my friends? They're not really from the devil. After looking at them for a while, you know, they're just kind of a bunch of crazy, harmless tree huggers who dance. And there's nothing really spiritual or godly about them, but they're not bad. You know, and so we haven't moved to being recognized by those people as people who pursue the sacred in the same way that they do, but they are gradually seeing us as being less of a direct threat and more like maybe we're just some crazies or something like that.
And okay.
That's progress. And
okay.
Well, you may not think it's progress, but after that happens, and then all of a sudden some terrible disaster happens, and you have a bunch of Christians who get hurt in the disaster, and you have pagans and goddess worshippers coming to their rescue and taking care of them, their perspective begins to change.
No, I can see that. Well, I guess sometimes I just wonder if they're morally reachable, you know, because even the argument of, well, you're my brother. I mean, you know, I'm sure you've been following the Paul Ryan budget, you know, and you know, they're sort of all about individualism, and I mean, you know what they represent. I mean, it's sometimes it seems like there is no morality there, you know, to be able to reach these people.
Yeah, one of the things that I've seen in some of these groups, and this does not apply for sure to all Christianity, I mean, there are many Christians who are on our side who do see what we're doing, and that's the good news.
Right, no, I
there
know.
There are just some who are far on the other side, and, you know, and almost all throughout history, there's always somebody on far of this side and far of that side, you know, who you can't do much with.
Right.
But I see a shift. When I started, I think I said this on your show before, when I started off talking about the goddess 40 years ago, I would go in churches and they would be saying, you know, Father God this, God with the beard, God this old man, God the whatever. And today, and for about the last 8 or 10 years, I have gone into many churches where they say Mother God, Father God. I've
mm-hmm.
even gone into Catholic churches where they say that. So us being present and in the dialogue and living next door to someone who feels the way some of these far-right fundamentalists do does gradually shift their perspective. It doesn't do it overnight. It takes a long time, and maybe it'll be 100 years before it's shifted. But it definitely is getting changed. The thing we have to be careful of is as it begins to shift, those on the very, very far right edges really feel like they're under attack, and
mm-hmm.
so they are coming back and getting more and more dangerous.
Right.
You know, so now instead of talking about, you know, just you know, we're crazy, they're saying, you know, we love you so much, we fear for you, we're going to kill you.
Well, that's what worried me about all the Muslim intolerance, you know, because
yeah.
we even had pagans in our community who were sort of jumping on the right-wing bandwagon, you know, being, you know, anti-Islam. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, it would just take one crazy pagan to do something, and all of that right-wing hysteria could be shifted against us.
Well, it could. You know, the thing that you always have to do is you have to do the best you can to pursue and present the truth all the time. And it doesn't make any difference what the people on the other side say. If it's not truth, and you are saying truth, people will gradually begin to see it. You know, there's in my own spiritual tradition, we have a saying. The saying goes like this: you can call a tree a bird, but it's still a tree. Truth and perception are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we have to move forward guided by our spirituality, by our connection with the mother, and we have to be present, and we have to stay in that space. And
right.
we have to trust that that in itself will gradually take care of the problem. And, you know,
no,
it's not an easy thing to do.
I appreciate that insight, Patrick, because sometimes it seems overwhelming, you know.
Well, I can tell you there's plenty of times I feel pretty overwhelmed by it all, but, you know, when I do, I just talk to her, and she reassures me, and I move forward.
Yep,
so that's
and you
kind
go
of what
on
we
to
need
the
to
next.
Do.
Go on to the next. All right, so now, I'm sorry, I made you ramble off the subject.
Yeah,
well,
I went
you
way
were,
off.
So you were in, I think you left off where you were in Thailand and becoming the World Inner Peace Ambassador. Was that
yeah,
where you left
so,
off?
Yes, so I became an Inner Peace Ambassador, and I had very remarkable experience in that they had the high lamas from various types of Buddhism, primarily Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism, but also a few others. And then they have other lamas who are from monasteries, and then they had monks that were there also. And when it got to the end, of my being with them, the High Lamas invited me to actually sit with them to be part of them as they spoke to the others. And it was quite a powerful move. And then at the very end, the thing that was the most moving for me out of my entire trip, you have to understand that the people that I was with are some of the highest, most respected spiritual leaders of Buddhism. I mean, you know, they're the very top. And one of the ones who's at the very top, they have a process in Buddhism, which I didn't really know about because I'm not a Buddhist, where the Buddha reveals to them the name for a person who's before them that becomes their Dharma name or their Buddha name, and it outlines what their kind of position and destiny in the world is. And they had that happen for me, and they named me in Tibetan Sheda Garpo, which means the King of Peace.
Ah.
And I was thinking, wow, you know, I mean, it just sounds so out there, you know.
Jesus-like.
I mean, that they would say something like that about me. And, you know, almost a day after that, I was invited to a series of different events, which is what I'm going to talk about next. And that is, I have now been invited to go on the peace ship, which was an idea proposed to the United Nations about 10 years ago. And what it is a ship that is going to go across Lake Baikal, which is in Siberia, and it's called the Eye of the Planet. It's one of the largest lakes in the world, and when you look from outer space, you can see it looks like a big giant eye, and it has an island in the middle, so it looks exactly like an eye. But it's not just that. It is considered to be one of the most pristine, untouched bodies of water in the world. And it's been a sacred place for many different spiritual traditions for thousands of years. And so the idea is that they wanted to invite a number of major world spiritual leaders, some world other kinds of leaders, you know, political leaders, and young people who had really shown that they have, you know, moved towards spirituality and world peace, and put us on this ship, and we're going to go across it for 3 days together. And, you know, like the Dalai Lama's going, I'm going, a few, you know, other people like that are going. And we're going to sit together and talk and be together every day and do everything together and live together on this boat and come up with a plan for world peace. So, you know, to
wow.
be a goddess worshiper and invited in that journey and to be present in that kind of company and have what you have to say heard
mm-hmm.
is huge.
Absolutely.
It's huge.
And it gives
you know?
Us all hope.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I'm very hopeful all the time. And then I've also been invited on, well, I've been invited to go on a trip to Nepal, so I'm leaving actually shortly, right after I get back from the trip I'm on now, to go to Nepal, Kathmandu, and into the Himalayas.
It must be hard for your wife. Does she get to go with you, or does she have to just hear about it when you get home?
She hasn't got to go so far, but I'm trying to work on it. She's very, you know, strong in the same belief system as I am, and she's a very well-recognized expert on, you know, world religions and on feminist spirituality, goddess spirituality. She's a priestess herself, and so she will be accompanying me in the future, but it just has not worked out that way,
right.
you know, up to this point. But,
well, Patrick, we just to give you a heads up on our time, we have about 12 minutes left.
Okay.
The time has flown really quickly. I know you're also, did you want to tell us more about what's going to happen in Nepal, or did you want to talk about your Guatemala trip coming up with the
okay.
Mayan prophecy?
Yeah, let me run by those. So I'm going to Nepal just for humanitarian project. And so I'm going to be working with interfaith leaders from a number of different traditions around the country, around the world, who are meeting in Kathmandu. And then I'm also going to be doing projects for the people there themselves, education projects, and doing some interaction discussion with the new government, a Maoist government there, for more human and religious rights. So then moving on from that, I have been invited on a Israeli-Palestinian peace project, and so I don't have a date for that yet, but that's something we could talk about after that comes together. But I'll be going to Israel and Palestine down the line in just a bit. And then the last thing is that when I was in Kazakhstan, and I made a connection with a number of these spiritual leaders and political leaders from around the world, I got asked to be on a board of spiritual leaders for an organization called the World Spirit Forum, made up of spiritual leaders from around the world, and they have a specific project. It's the Guatemala 2012 project. We've been invited by the Mayan priests. Most everybody knows about the 2012 prophecies and such. And so I'm one of the people in charge of bringing the spiritual elders from the indigenous traditions and all the other traditions from around the world to Guatemala into the Mayan lands to fulfill the 2012 prophecy as they see it. And, you know, you see these movies about, you know, it's like the end of the world and all the rest of that. But really that has come from a Abrahamic overview of indigenous ideas. So the Mayans basically said there's going to be a big change in the world, and of course they take it on as it's the end of the world, the apocalypse, all the rest of that. But what the Mayans really saw, and other indigenous tribes, is that there would be a huge spiritual change in the world, and that the spiritual elders and the young would come together and meet and have a conversation about a new world. And that is what I'm facilitating.
Now, you know, I can't resist asking you, and how do I ask you without making it sound like I think you have a crystal ball? I guess I'll just say it. What do you think the shift is going to look like? I mean, will it be something we'll really see or, you know, manifesting in our everyday lives?
Well, let me tell you, I have, you know, in the last couple of years, I've literally been traveling around the world interacting as, you know, a spiritual person from my spiritual perspective, you know, from the divine feminine. And I can tell you that there is a hunger in many, many of the countries in the world and in many, many of the religions and spirituality to both save our planet, even though there might be some Tea Partiers that don't think there's global warming. People all over the world are seeing different signs of it, and to them they clearly see there's something happening. And they want peace in the world. You know, it used to be if somebody killed a bunch of people over in some country across the ocean, you didn't even hear about it for a year or two, and nobody seemed to really care all that much. But today, when you're sitting at home and somebody, you know, tweets you and then sends you a YouTube of them cutting people's heads off or shooting 50 people in the street in some country across the world, you can't help but be moved by it. And so the world has become a very close place. And so all these people are coming forward, primarily spiritual people from many traditions, and they're saying, look, let's find a way to set aside our differences and to find our commonalities and to join together in our spirituality in its diversity as a sacred thing, and let's save humanity and our planet. And this is happening everywhere in huge ways. And so for me, what the Guatemala Project is, what I believe it really is, the whole shift, is a paradigm shift to a different way of looking at things. Right now, we're really following a shift, which I would attribute to a particular religious bent, but I'm not going to identify that. The listeners can make that up for themselves as to what I'm talking about. But there's an idea that there are some people who are saved and some people who aren't, and that people can be commodified, and that it's okay to do atrocities to people who are not in your saved group.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's okay to exploit the actual planet that we live on that gives us our sustenance and everything, because it's a gift from God to do whatever we want with.
Mm-hmm.
And the paradigm shift is that is not true. You cannot just devour the planet and have nothing happen. You cannot just use other people because they aren't in your religion or your whatever. You have to find a way for us all to get along together, because here's the one downside. If there isn't an apocalypse, we're screwed. Because, you know, if the world isn't going to end, then we better start getting it together. And that's what I think that the 2012 shift is. I think it's about people coming together and recognizing that, you know what, you're a woman, I'm a man, we're different. You know, that guy over there is black and I'm white, he and I are different. A person over there believes in the grand poobah of the tree, and I believe in the spirit of the fish in the water. We're different in those ways. But it is the diversity of who we are that shows what the sacred intends for us. Because God, Goddess, or whatever it is that made us like we are, and we are sure as heck not all the same.
Right.
And so that is where we're headed.
Well, it sounds good to me, and it can't come quick enough. I'm waiting for somebody to tell me where to go march in the street, you know?
Well, I'll tell you one other thing, if you don't mind my throwing a little personal thing in. But,
No, we have about 5 minutes, just so
okay.
You know where we are in time.
Well, a group of people came together and started the foundation in my name called the Patrick McCollum Foundation. And it's the foundation of world peace. And we are now partnering with Buddhists and Hindus and Native Americans and stuff in large, large groups and numbers around the world, and having come people together. And we're all working together hand in hand through spirituality to bring world peace and sustainability to our planet. So if people are interested in doing something rather than just talking about it, they could go on our website, see what's going on, see what they can do to help. If they're not a person who can do anything and don't want to go do anything, they could send $10. And if they want to go on a project, hey, if someone contacts me and they want to go to Guatemala or they want to go to, you know, Nepal and do something, and they have some skills and things like that, I'm willing to take them on board.
Well, and obviously all of these things you're doing, I know you're not independently wealthy.
I'm not.
And you have no wealthy benefactor either that I'm aware of.
Nope.
Does your foundation need support?
We absolutely do. I mean, the way that I'm somewhat embarrassed to say this, but I'm trying to get to a place where I can just express what the truth is. For 10 years now, the last 10 years, I've done this work, and all of the work has been supported by my wife and myself entirely by mortgaging our house, selling our stuff, and putting all our salaries and everything we got into it. So we have put everything, our retirement, our house, everything, and we have nothing left. So we are at a place where, you know, if people believe in what it is, they can see that the work myself and some of the other people with me are doing, then they can help out. And, we're not some big, giant organization like some of them. I mean, you know, where you have no idea where your money's going or what's happening to it. This is pretty rubber-to-the-road stuff. It's like, okay, I'm flying to Nepal, and there are 1,500 kids who live on the street who have no education and no food, no one to take care of them, and they're getting institutionalized in prisons because there's a law being passed that if you're a minor and you're living on the street, that you're violating the law. And so I'm going over there to change that. And it costs, you know, a couple $1,000s to buy a plane ticket, and it costs whatever. But I have like a 95% success rate at these things.
Right.
So if somebody would like to go help 1,500 kids have a life, then, you know, you can help by donating to our organization. And the same thing, if you want someone who can represent you, who speaks from the position of the goddess and empowering women and all those kind of things like that, who's going to sit down with the Dalai Lama and the presidents of countries and everything and talk about what we want, I got to buy a ticket to get there.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so, you know, I've never, in the entire time I've done my work, ever asked for anything from anybody. But it has gotten to be that the work is so big, I don't know how to do it any other way.
Right.
And so there are
well,
people
and,
trying
and
to show
up. Well,
and
you know what,
up.
Patrick, there's nothing wrong with asking for support because you're doing the work for all of us. This isn't, you know, this isn't about, you know, your ego or selfishness or trying to pad your pockets. You know, you're doing the work
of
the world.
Absolutely not. So anyone who'd like to either donate money or just help or even just keep track of what is going on, they can go to patrickmccollum.org. And there's, you know, there's all the information about the Thailand trips and the Nepal trips and the Israel trips and the other things. And there's the court case stuff and all those different things. And all the updates and everything will be on there regularly.
Okay.
And I try to be available. So, you know, a lot of people who do the kind of work I do aren't available. It's like, you know, you can't call up whoever and say, hey, you know, I want to know what's going on. But you can call me up. You can email
okay.
me, and I will respond to you, whoever you are.
Well,
you know?
I can attest to that.
Yeah. So, anyway, and I don't know what else you might like to talk about, but that's
well,
probably
we,
enough
well,
about
we're,
that.
Well, you know, I could talk to you for another hour, but we are out of time. At this point, I barely have time to say goodbye to you. We have about 30 seconds left.
Okay.
But I just want to say thank you, Patrick. You know, thank you for the work you're doing in the world for all of us. I feel better knowing you're out there, and I appreciate that you come back and talk to me and my listeners, and you give us hope, and you give us updates, and you give us insight. And, you know, you help us know how to conduct ourselves so that, you know, we're worthy representatives of Goddess ourselves. So I just want to say thank you. And again, listeners, it is the Patrick McCollum Foundation, McCollum. Patrick, you're welcome back anytime. Please come again and keep us apprised of everything you're doing.
I will. Thank you so much, Karen. And I would also like to extend a personal thanks to all the women, the really literally millions of women who stepped forward and stood up, you know, for what they believe in, because it's not easy to do. I've seen that, you know, over the years. And I'm just one guy, you know, trying to make a shift over someplace. But really these shifts are being made because of all the women who've come forward in shows like yours and these kind of things. And
well,
so
thank you, Patrick,
really
but what a guy you are.
Okay.
You're
right,
our
you
brother in
night.
Arms, without a doubt.
All right, have a wonderful night.
Well, thank you, Patrick, and good night.
All right, good night.